Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, and it is the season that I have been waiting for so long. Spring is finally upon us full time, and it has been such a brutal winter. So for those of you like me who are at least have a little patch of ground where you can get some plants planted, vegetables, flowers, whatever, or if you have a big patch and a farm like our guests and have lots of vegetables planted, or if you're one of those people who are just haunting the green markets and can't wait for the bounty of the season to arrive, we have got the show for you today. The fabulous Beekman boys are back with me. Josh Kilmer-Purcell, I'm sorry, Josh, I always screw up the two names.
Name.
Josh Kilmer-Purcell and Brent Ridge of the popular Beekman 1802 radio mercantile shop in Sharon Springs, New York, and, of course, their well-known television series, The Fabulous Beekman Boys, on the Cooking Channel, are with me. And welcome. How did you take a break from the farm today?
Well, the new cookbook is out, so yeah. We're touring around for that, and we love it here in Brooklyn. We feel like hipsters just sitting here. We feel like 30 years younger just sitting here.
That's why I come.
Yeah.
Well, Brent, you mentioned that the cookbook is out, and that's what I failed to mention, is that you are also the authors of the famous series of the Beekman 1802 heirloom cooking series, the heirloom cookbook. Then last season you had the heirloom dessert book, and now you have, I think, my favorite of all, if I have to pick one, is the heirloom vegetable cookbook. It is a beautiful cookbook with, once again, with your collaborator, Sandy Gluck, and the photos by Paulette Tavermina, which are just outstanding. I congratulate you. It's a beautiful book.
Thank you. Yeah, we want to make sure when we do a cookbook that it's heirloom quality. You know, not just the recipes will last forever, use them forever, but we want to make sure the book itself is beautiful and something that you're going to take off the shelf and enjoy, you know, for years to come.
Which is sort of a little theme. I don't want to say gimmick because it's something you've put in each of your books, and that's a place for people to take notes after each recipe. Right?
Exactly.
Because, you know, if you are at a rummage sale and you're looking through a box of books, the one that you're most attracted to is the one with handwriting in it.
Right.
And so we really
that's proof of concept. I think when you see a cookbook with a lot of writing in it, that means it was used, that means the recipes are good, you know, and it means somebody loved it. And I think that's what makes, that's how you know it's a good cookbook.
Right.
And we
right.
want the books to be heirlooms in your family, and, you know, so that when someone passes it down to the next generation and they open it up, they're going to see your handwriting in that book, and it just makes it special in your family. It's kind of becomes a little scrapbook.
Mm-hmm. Well, now you have billed this book as 100 delicious heritage recipes. And from the farm and garden. And yet I was reading through, and you did do some of your own takes on things. So they're not exactly you know, old style recipes that, you know.
Exactly. It's not a history book. You know, as much as we love, you know, the history of food and the history of different recipes, it's we call it heirloom or heritage. It's something that it's a recipe that you make over and over again. The recipes that we made over and over again ourselves, they come from our families, but we've updated them. We've put twists on them because we think recipes are living things. Mm-hmm. You know, they can live a long life, you know, for years and years and years and generations, but they, you know, they can change along
they
the way and should
time.
Change.
And they evolve, right? Evolve mm-hmm. over time, Brent. Well, what a little bit of history about the two of you, which I don't know if people, if they haven't seen your show or if they haven't read a lot about you on your website, because you have a beautiful website too, which has just won an award for a lifestyle.
Right, Beekman1802.com.
There you go. And you can read all about the boys. But you didn't, you weren't on this direct trajectory to farming and farming and these very popular books. I mean, Brent, you were a physician. Oh, you are a physician.
That was my first career.
Right, practicing physician.
My first career.
Right. And Josh, and you were a writer in advertising, and both on successful other careers, and then just had it with City Life, right?
Well, City Life kind of had it with us.
Yeah.
Because we both grew up in the country. I grew up in rural North Carolina, and Josh grew up in rural Wisconsin. And so we both had gardening in our backgrounds. And you know, we made our way to New York City and kind of had our careers here. And we say that our first farm was actually on the rooftop of our Upper East Side apartment building, because that's where we really started growing vegetables again.
Yeah.
Heirloom tomatoes.
See, we were hipster before there was even Brooklyn.
That's right. And then, you know, we bought this place in upstate New York, in Sharon Springs, New York, that we thought was going to be our weekend getaway and eventually a retirement, you know, place. And we purchased that in 2007, had cashed in everything that we had ever saved, you know, to buy this this place. And then in 2008, when the economy crashed, we both lost our jobs in the city.
Within 30 days of each other.
Wow.
We went from two great paychecks to none. We had a huge mortgage on the farm. We had a mortgage in the city. And we were like, how are we going to pay for this farm? And we said, we're going to have to start farming.
So we pulled ourselves up by our bootstraps and, you know, started the farm and took in a farmer who was losing his farm. And he brought his goats with him. Farmer John. And
I love those goats.
Yes,
thank
they're
you.
Amazing.
Goats, yeah.
And that's really how it all started.
Well, speaking of, you pulled yourself up from the bootstraps, and now you have your own line of boots, I see.
That's right. Yeah.
we will have to take a picture of those and post those on our website.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, I think anybody that knows our story knows that we approach farming in a very different way. You know, we started with our goats. We started with goat milk soap, goat milk cheese. But then we started approaching neighbors and other farms around us in upstate New York that were struggling, like many small farms. And we started working with them, realizing – so they were teaching us how to farm and how to survive in a small community. And we were teaching them how to market. And we were using our skills from this that we'd learned in the city to help them
sell their products. It's that country bartering style.
It really is, you know. And people may not think of marketing as a, you know, as a very valuable bartering skill. But these people were making great products. There were weavers and blacksmiths and other farmers that were making these wonderful things, but they weren't able to sell them and distribute them. And so that's how Beekman 1802 was born. It wasn't just our farm and our products. It was a collective of everyone in our region mm-hmm. making things. And we branded them and we called up our friends in New York City and helped sell them.
And that was the name of the house that you bought. The property you bought was
right.
Beekman.
Yeah, it was originally built by a gentleman named William Beekman in the year 1802.
It is beautiful property. I have to say I have been there.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
What I wanted to mention to people who might know you from your television show. You know, some people do and some people mm-hmm. don't. They
yes.
don't get all those
yep.
channels. But your show chronicles your life on the farm. You mm-hmm. get all mm-hmm. the foibles and the fights and the fun and the, you know.
Yeah.
What people don't know is that you take this very seriously, the farming.
And, oh, yes.
And that doesn't make for good. People don't want to see sweat and toil. They want to see fun and fantasy,
yes.
you know. But I know that you take it very seriously, and it is a very serious farm. And Brent, you told me right before the show that this book is filled. You'll have to realize, everyone, when you see it, and I did post a picture of it on the website, on Facebook, I think. Yeah. And the pictures there are, each season is prefaced by this spread of gorgeous vegetables, each individually kind of set out on a white table. And Brent, you gave me the information.
Yes, all the vegetables that we used in the book were from our farm. We raise about 80% of all the food that we personally consume on the farm. That includes the meat and the vegetables. We don't raise any grains, so that's the 20%. We do like a lot yeah. of bread and pasta. But
I'm sure it's local.
Yes, when we can. And, you know, for us, you know, this idea of growing your own thing and appreciating particularly heirloom varieties is just really important to us. And we think it makes, you know, our dishes incredible. And that's really how a lot of the recipes come about. You know, we kind of take those those ideas and those techniques that we learned growing up from our grandmothers and mothers. And then as things are coming in fresh on the farm and we're harvesting them, you know, you always get to that period where you're like, huh, I've got all these zucchini. What am I going to do with zucchini? Or tomatoes are coming out of my ears. What am I going to do with all the tomatoes? And that's really how our recipes come about, is that we, you know, we'll go out to the, we cook dinner every single night that we're at home, and we'll go out to the garden and say, oh, what, you know, what needs to be harvested? And then we come back in with it and we're like, okay, what can we do with it? And that's really how the recipes come about and how we modernize kind of the recipes that we grew up
with. Well, and this book, like all of our other books you mentioned earlier, is separated by spring, summer, winter, and fall. You know, it's all the book itself is separated that way. And it comes in particularly handy with the vegetables, because right. This is the time of year that you're going to the farmer's market, that you're getting your big CSA box, and you open it up and there's, you know, 7 pounds of chard.
What can you do?
Exactly.
Oh, chard again tonight, huh?
And that exactly. And that was sort of our, you know, doing our cookbooks, as we said earlier, we want them to be used. And so I think that one of the hardest things about using a cookbook is a starting point. You know, you a lot of us have beautiful cookbooks at home, and we flip through them, and there's just, you know, well, there's breakfast and appetizers and main courses. But I need a better starting point. I need, like, it's summer. Here's what I got. Here's what I want to make.
You know, it's funny. That's exactly the reaction I had mm-hmm. to the book. As I was leafing through it, I, you know, looked at and marked some recipes I wanted to talk about. And then on the way here, I was just leafing through it, you know, in general purpose. I said, wow, I could actually cook from this book every night of the week when a no-brainer. I mean, I would just go page by page by page, because you take me right through the seasons. And they're really scrumptious looking food. I'm sure they taste this is good.
We really wanted, you know, people to actually be able to take this book with them to the farmer's market. And whenever something was most bountiful, and, you know, when something is most bountiful, that's when it's the cheapest in the season.
Right.
So, you know, to take the book with them and say, oh, look, there's the leek are in. You know, what can you make with leek? Or the sweet peas are in. What can you make with the sweet peas? That's really how we wanted people to use it, to actually take it with them to the market and then look in the index and say, oh, sweet peas, I'm going to make this recipe.
Well, and you did include a small section, but you did, you know, give a section to pickling, which is so huge to fermentation, pickling.
And horseradish.
And horseradish.
We have three types of horseradish in the
book. Even talk to me about horseradish. It's like horseradish is something you don't plant, but
it's
you
true.
Harvest it like crazy.
That's true.
Well, pickling and preserving is such a hot topic now, and there are books that are 4 inches thick about it, and we've been asked to write books, and honestly, people are so interested in it, but I think they're getting intimidated by it because there seem to be so many procedural things you need to do. Here's how, if you want to pickle something, here's how you start. You get a jar, you fill it half with vinegar, half with water, throw in some herbs, and throw in some vegetables, put it in your fridge.
Make a refrigerator.
And you're making pickles.
Refrigerator pickle.
Right. And that's how I think it's a great way for a lot of people to start.
I mean, unless you live, you know, like unless you have so much produce that you have to put up jars and jars and jars of it. I mean, that has to stay down in the basement or something. It is true. You did a lot of really nice, quick pickle.
And
that's good. Yeah.
Just as rewarding.
Yeah. Do you keep a root cellar?
We have the house's original root cellar.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And so we can a lot. And as I said, we raise or grow about 80% of the food that we personally consume. So we really eat all winter on what we put up. And, you know, we have big, you know, bushel barrels of potatoes down there, and onions and garlic.
And our garlic, it was so cold this year. Even the basement was cold. Our garlic lasted all year.
Yeah.
Great.
So, yeah.
We put apples down there. I mean, we've...
Huh. Interesting. Yeah.
And you want to know something? One bad apple really does.
It does. But then you know what you do? You leave it alone and let it ferment. Well, you'll have some good apple juice.
Exactly.
Are there any vegetables that you grow or have grown? You talk about heirloom vegetables, and you have the wonderful old Landreth seed packets as pictures too. Mm-hmm. And I know them well. I have some of their pictures too.
Yeah.
And there's so much history there of the old seed companies. But are there any vegetables that you have grown that you've brought back that have disappeared from the American table?
Well,
there are things that aren't very common, like, or people have heard of but never tried, like rutabaga.
Rutabaga, right. I think kohlrabi. You mentioned something about kohlrabi.
Kohlrabi.
Yeah.
And
people don't know what to do with it.
Celery root.
Right.
You know, there are just things that aren't very common, but they're so delicious. And we try to have even recipes for those things because, you know, even if you're not at the farmer's market, most, you know, bigger grocery stores now will have a few of all of those things.
Right.
And people pass them by because they don't know how to use them.
And this is what I say. Whenever you meet an unfamiliar vegetable on the street, don't cross the street. No, you should anything can be roasted. You know, people always ask, like, oh, I saw turnips, I saw rutabagas, I saw this, I don't know what to do. Anything can be roasted. Toss it in olive oil, put it on a baking sheet, put it in a 400-degree oven until it's soft, and then try it.
There you go.
And,
grilled. So coming up in summer months, things are, I mean, you can grill, you know, endive, you can grill fennel, you can, I mean, there's so many amazing things to throw on the grill.
And Brent and I love to keep, you know, when you make salad dressing, there's always a little bit left over in the jar or whatever. We just keep all that in the fridge, and then after you roast your vegetables, just toss your vegetables in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing.
Great idea. That's terrific. Well, you know what? We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I want to talk about some of the specific recipes that you've included in this book. So stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years. So it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Hi, we are back, and I'm talking with Josh and Brent, the fabulous Beekman boys, who they've just come out with a new book in their series of heirloom cookbooks, and it's the Heirloom Vegetable Cookbook. So we are going to talk about some of these specific recipes, and you asked me if I had some favorites, and everything's a favorite. I mean, it all looks so good. One thing that you had, and I was looking at the season, since nothing's really in season yet except the baby lettuces and some radishes kept popping through. Looking at some that we can kind of get from any time, but you have this recipe for corn cake stacks. Oh, that looks delicious.
And this is probably, the book has been out now for 2 weeks, and that's probably one of the recipes that people have tried first. It's really easy to make. It's corn and red pepper, and you make these delicious cakes in the skillet, and then you put cheddar cheese in between them and bake them, and it's just so
And it's good. Actually, it's an egg white, beaten egg white base. There's I hate to say gluten-free because, you know, I'm tired of it too, but it actually is coincidentally gluten-free.
It happens to be, right.
So it's just cornmeal and beaten egg white, so... it's a really lovely light cake,
and they're like little pancakes, or
exactly.
And they're
and they're great.
Delicious.
We
and
stack them up with cheese.
Them, you can even use them to kind of make a BLT. So you make two of the cakes,
and then instead of the bread.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And it's so delicious.
Smart, yeah. Well, I also I forgot to mention one of the other things is the salt crusted baked potatoes.
Yes.
Oh boy, that called out to me.
Well, this idea came to us because of the salt potatoes, which was a very kind of historic thing from upstate New York. Have you ever had the salt potatoes?
Yes.
And that's
but please explain.
Sure. So the salt potatoes came from, a lot of people don't know that a lot of salt was mined in upstate New York, and for many years in the early part of the 1900s, most of America's salt came from upstate New York. And so there were immigrants, you know, a lot of them Irish immigrants who were working in the salt mines. And you had to get water really hot when you were mining the salt. And so what they would do is, you know, because you're evaporating the water and, you know, collecting the salt that way. And so the Irish immigrants would bring potatoes and put it into the hot water to boil for their lunch. And so by the time lunch came around, the potatoes would be perfectly cooked, and they had a salty taste because they were boiling them in salt water. Mm-hmm. And so that became a big thing in upstate New York, the salt potatoes. And you can actually go to lots of restaurants or fairs in upstate New York, and they'll give you like a brown paper bag with salt potato, boiled salt potatoes. Really delicious.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Let me see what else. Oh, vegetables. We're talking a way to sneak some vegetables into your child's meal, and what kid doesn't like macaroni and cheese? You've got this great mac and cheese recipe.
Yes. And we have a few sneaky vegetable recipes, one of which is the mac and cheese, and it's got squash and carrots and onions, and my favorite is the topping. It has the bacon popcorn topping.
Popcorn topping. Yeah, I would just – the bacon popcorn, you can just give me on the just, side. I'll eat that straight.
Eat it plain.
Well, the bacon popcorn recipe was really – you know, because we wanted this book to be for people who love vegetables and for people who didn't love vegetables. So how could you introduce people into vegetables? And so, you know, in any book, you want to have something that's just fun and witty. And so we came up with this idea for bacon popcorn.
Wait, is bacon a vegetable?
Yeah, in my book, it is.
Corn kind of is. Yeah. And so so for the bacon popcorn, it's so easy to make. What you do is you get a really great bacon and you fry it up really crispy. And then you take the renderings and you use the renderings to make your popcorn. Mm-hmm. And then you crumble the extra crispy bacon into the popcorn when you eat it. And it's so good. And for this particular mac and cheese recipe, what we did, instead of breadcrumbs to give it the little crunch, we sprinkle the popcorn over the top of the macaroni and
That's
cheese.
That's such a great idea. That's good.
We also have a great breakfast muffin in there. It's a cheddar vegetable muffin that uses, again, sneak some summer squash into the muffins, which is great when you have kids, yeah, just to get a little extra fiber, a little extra vitamins in.
Right. Although, and, you know, I think more and more kids are appreciating the vegetables if they get the fresh ones.
That's true. My favorite story is that we had a kid come up to the farm with his mom. He was probably 3 or 4 years old, and we were going through the garden. I was giving him carrots and things right out of the ground, washing them off, and he had hands full of vegetables, and he just putting them as fast as he could in his mouth, and his mom said, "I've never seen him this way with vegetables before." And the kid looked up at her and said, "These are vegetables?" Just with fear and terror in his eyes. Yeah.
Fresh, they taste so much better. Well, it's no lie that, of course, some people just don't like certain vegetables. You know,
yes,
some people just don't have a taste for them. Now, one that was an issue with the two of you happened to be eggplant.
Yes.
Eggplant is not my favorite.
Yes, we argue about that a lot.
Because Josh likes eggplant, and I've just never had an affinity for it. But we came up with a way for this book to make them so that I can't tolerate it. And these are meatless eggplant. I don't know if you can even call them meatballs.
Meatballs. Well, you have to put it in quotation marks.
Eggplant meatless balls.
Yeah. But they have a lot of Parmesan in it, which makes it very palatable to you.
Yeah.
And you can use them, you know, if you're making pasta sauce, you can use them just in your pot, like you're making spaghetti and meatballs.
Eggplants, like summer squash, like any of those soft vegetables, you know, they just soak up whatever sauce.
Well, that's just, I was going to say, it's a good sponge.
Yeah, yeah, right. Exactly.
It's a really good sponge. One that I noticed that is something I definitely want to try for a dinner party because it looks so beautiful, and that is the arugula sorbet. And I have to say, you do wonderful.
The Jell-O salad. Yeah.
Oh, the Jell-O salad.
Yeah.
You give wonderful head notes that give a little background on a lot of these. Mm-hmm. And surprising to a lot of people, in fact, it was not, well, it was sort of surprising to me because I was in Italy for so many years before I came here and was used to arugula. When I came back, there it was.
Right.
And hadn't seen it before. So give me the story about arugula.
Well, I mean, it really wasn't popular in the United States until the 70s. And, it, you know, around the world, it's called rocket.
Mm-hmm.
And that's... you know, and
it wasn't even really cultivated, and people didn't.
No, it was wild thing. And there's still wild arugula, if you can find it, is more amazing than regular arugula. But this recipe,
we really have the hippies to thank for arugula.
Oh, and and the Italian immigrants.
Oh, that's true.
Yes,
because my daughter told me a story just the other day when I showed her that picture. She said, You know, one of the funny memories I have of living in the suburbs, as we did at the time, she said, even there, you know, you drive up along the Taconic or something, and there were green hills on the sides of the roads. She said, all the Italian ladies would come out in the spring, and they'd be picking. And then she found out that they were, you know, picking
doing arugula.
Right. Yeah.
Well, and this particular
and
recipe.
Ramp, too,
this
oh, I'm sure, yeah.
Yeah, this teacup Jell-O salad. This was, you know, we got the eggplant in, you know, I got that in, and this was the other one I fought for, because I don't have a lot of recipes in the books, heirloom recipes, because my family's from the Midwest, Brent's is from the South, so the Southern culture has much more cuisine background than mine.
No, wait a minute, I'm from the Midwest too. We'll talk about Midwest cuisine on another show.
I know, well, let's say I had to fight to get more Midwestern dishes in there, but as we know, Jell-O is one of the staples of Midwestern cuisine, but it's very hard to get a Jell-O recipe in a cookbook, you know. And so we created this teacup arugula Jell-O salad.
And you know, it sounds terrible.
That would probably never be sold or never be served in Wisconsin, but
it sounds terrible. And so that's actually one of the reasons we wanted to take such a beautiful picture of it for the book, because we wanted to entice people to actually make this recipe, because you made the mistake when you were introducing it to say sorbet,
right?
Because it does, you can actually use it as a sorbet, as a palate cleanser.
That's what I was thinking of doing, right. Serving it between courses as a little salad.
It has a great
cleanser.
Ricotta cheese, a little bit of lime, the Jell-O, and
it is
arugula.
So refreshing.
It's wonderful. It's a really great dish.
Of course, I like savory desserts, too. It would be fine for dessert for me.
Yeah.
Anything that was a lot of fun for you to work on that was one of your favorites, or a couple of them? Or...
Oh, what do we have?
Josh, I see you leafing through the book.
I know.
You wanted to talk about.
Yeah, nothing really makes it in there that's not our favorite.
The rhubarb chicken.
Ooh.
That's one of my favorites. So there's the masala chicken with rhubarb, which has a lot of Indian spices in it. Because rhubarb on the farm, we celebrate rhubarb. I mean, I could have a ceremony when rhubarb comes up, because after the long winter, that's the very first green thing
we
see.
Right.
And so, you know, and rhubarb isn't used a lot culinarily.
They make a rhubarb pie, but then they throw strawberries in with it.
Exactly.
So
you don't even get to appreciate
rhubarb,
it.
Yeah.
So I was determined to put it in a main dish. So we created this rhubarb masala chicken that uses garam masala spices and other Indian. And it's tremendous.
You know, that's one thing that I thought was interesting. There are a lot of vegetable cookbooks that have come out on the market in the last couple of years. Beautiful ones too, Deborah Madison Martha Rose Schulman. And they're fabulous cookbooks. They are strictly vegetarian vegetable cookbooks. This cookbook does incorporate a few meat dishes.
That's right. Well, you know, I would say probably 80%,
not a lot.
80%, maybe 85% of them are purely vegetable, but we're not vegetarian. We're omnivores. And so we wanted to create a book for both people. So, and just really create recipes that pushed the vegetable forward in the recipe, even if it included meat, and really helped that vegetable shine.
Right. Well, you know, there's a wonderful, I guess, philosophy that a few people have adopted, and that's let's move the meat from the center of the plate to the sides. Right, and push the vegetables in the center. And I think that's a wonderful.
Oh, I always love, I'm going to. Committing a sin, Moosewood Cookbook.
Yeah, she was on my show. I was.
You know, I'm talking about this terrible. Yes. But anyway, she
Molly Katz.
Yes, thank you so much. Yes. But she always says, "Small V vegetarianism. Not capital V. It's not a religion. It can be. You know, you can incorporate it. You don't have to look at it like, oh, I'm becoming vegetarian, I'm never eating meat again. Just incorporate more vegetables in. And that's kind of what we've done.
Right. Well, you also include some dessert recipes, which is kind of cool. That one in particular that I love is the corn chess pie. I mean, who doesn't love chess? Those who don't know about chess pie, because not everybody does. I mean, it's basically just a sugar pie.
Yeah, it is. It's,
well, and people don't realize how much sugar is in corn. I mean, sweet corn has a lot of sugar.
Right.
So you think, oh, what corn in a dessert? But it actually makes a really delicious pie. And then the other thing that's in the book is the beet chocolate cake.
Mm.
And if you've never used beet sugar before, when you put it, particularly in the chocolate cake, it makes the chocolate taste...
it gives
so
it like
much
an earthy
dense
spiciness.
And earthy. It's a really complex flavor. And then we show you how to make candied beets to go on the top of it. It just turns really beautiful.
I love that little tip there, too. And you do give a lot of interesting tips. I mean, it's packed with, with useful information. But when you said about pushing the vegetables forward, you know, it's it's true. Most everyone knows what to do with meat. Yeah, you can have some new recipes, like the rhubarb chicken sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
But everyone knows, okay, you can roast a chicken, or you can fry it, or you can broil it. But vegetables, people are often at a loss.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Well, because so many times growing up, the only exposure you have to the vegetable is something that's been really boiled. You know, like you were at your school and your lunch was, you know, boiled broccoli, you know, or something like that. So people never really learn how to work with vegetables.
Well, and that's where, you know, we talked earlier about roasting the vegetables and how anybody can roast a vegetable, do something. And I also, on weeknights, we do sort of the phased roasting approach where if you experiment a little, you know, some vegetables take a long time to roast, some don't take so long. So we just use the same tray, you throw carrots or things. Yeah, you throw the softer ones on later. You know, roast the hard ones for 5 minutes, pull it out, add some softer ones, and, you know, pull it all together with a salad dressing or some sort of tapenade.
Yeah.
And it's delicious.
That's true. Well, it makes me very hungry to look at these beautiful pictures.
Thank you.
You have really done a lot of work, I have to say. So, you know, between the farming and the television shows and the writing, of course, you have a wonderful collaborator, too, which doesn't
she
hurt.
We have a great team of people.
Yeah.
I will say, you know, the inspiration for this particular book, and you talk about the work of Paulette Tavermina, our photographer, who we've worked with for all three cookbooks. Her style of photography in the first two books was really dark and moody and kind of provocative, I like to say. And so for the vegetable book, we really wanted to mimic vintage seed catalogs and seed packages. And so I went to Paulette and I said, okay, Paulette, you're really going to have to step outside of your comfort zone, and because this book is all about color and saturation and selling the vegetables way.
Yeah, that's right. You got to make them look good.
And what was really fun was that there's this great museum in Pennsylvania, the Landes Valley Farmers Museum, and there's a historian there, Dr. Irwin Richman, and he has the world's largest collection of seed catalogs and seed packets, and you can go and see some of them. And so I went and spent a day with him and went through his entire archive, and all of the vintage drawings that are used in the book are part of his collection. And it's just so inspiring to see that beautiful art and to hear him talk about the marketing of vegetables and how the seed catalogs really started almost every kind of marketing trick or gimmick that you see and use today. The seed catalog started, you know, like in terms of, you know, blowing things up really big to make them look more voluptuous, and like taglines and gimmicks like mortgage lifter, you know,
yes,
that became,
right.
You know,
famous tomato.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, all of those things started with seed and vegetable marketing.
And they'd send them out. I mean, they would send them out to everyone.
Every household. Landreth Seed in the 1800s sent a catalog to every house in America.
Wow.
They were like the yellow pages of their day.
Huh. And,
actually, we don't even have yellow pages anymore.
That's right.
What do we have now?
I don't know. Finder?
Yeah, I guess so.
Well, Josh, you
oh, yes, I came to my favorite page. The rutabaga with the Guinness glaze.
Yeah.
And I was going to say, that's another great way. Anybody that doesn't know what to do with vegetable, again, put it on a baking sheet. Throw a little brown sugar on it or with your salt and things and a bottle of Guinness.
Wow.
And just roast it away in the Guinness. And when the Guinness is just about gone, you don't want to over-roast it.
I was saying, doesn't it crystallize and burn on the bottom
eventually?
It
thickens up.
Mm-hmm. Makes a syrup.
A lot of times, if you learn to dice it the right way, about a one-inch, for a hard vegetable, about a one-inch chop, by the time the Guinness is evaporated enough to create a syrup, the vegetable is done too, and you just toss it.
Oh, terrific. I'm definitely going
to
try that.
Oh, can I go back to the seed catalogs for 1 second?
Yeah.
I mean, I love seed catalogs, but one of the fun things that we did in this book is throughout it, when I was going through the old seed catalogs, I would look at little bits and pieces of information that the seed catalogs used to sell the thing. And so those became the tidbits that are scattered throughout the book. And so with each recipe, there's some little tidbit about that vegetable that's meant to be a conversation starter. So if you're putting that vegetable maybe on your table for the first time, you can say, did you know that this vegetable was...
Sound like an expert, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Little conversation starters.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny because in rutabaga especially, I mean, you look at the rutabaga, you say, people don't even know what it is.
That's right.
And then if you learn to recognize it, you have no idea what to do.
That's right.
It, you know,
same thing with kohlrabi.
When you see
kohlrabi, you're like, that is from outer space.
Yeah, that's right. And both of them are good raw.
Yes, very good. Delicious.
Well, there is so much to learn from this book. And again, if you love looking at these old seed packet pictures. And you also give lists of some good seeds, like the Seed Savers, the Hudson Valley Seed Library.
Yes.
And you give sources for very good seeds, too. And it's not too late.
No, we still got a lot in the ground.
Yeah. Yeah. And then come the, you know,
fall plantings.
Fall planting, right. There are so many good sources for good heirloom seeds and organic seeds. And this book just does it all.
It gives it all, as well as a
fun coffee table picture book as well.
It is. Yes. Even if you're not a cook, you would like to read this book and just look at this book. It has that quality to it.
So if you're stumped, as you say, if you said, okay, I'm going to do the right thing, I'll join a CSA, and you end up with a box of kohlrabi and rutabaga, don't fret. You'll know what to do, right? Josh Kilmer-Purcell and Brent Ridge, thank you so much for joining me once again, the fabulous Beekman Boys. The book is The Beekman 1802 Heirloom Vegetable Book. And, of course, you can catch them on television and on their website, Beekman 1802. Thanks for listening. This has been A Taste of the Past, and I'm your host, Linda Pelaccio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Alweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.